Well, hello, grievers. Mandy here. Restorative grief is all about creating easy access to healing, no matter where or who you are. That's why I want you to remember that if you want grief support beyond a podcast, our Patreon features monthly workbooks to accompany each episode, as well as a Discord channel for more private chats and occasional bonus content as well. Supporting this work with your finances means investing in your own wellness and the healing of others, and that in itself is an incredibly generous and restorative practice. The link to the Patreon is in the show notes, but reach out with questions, okay? Now, let's get on to this week's episode. Welcome back to Restorative Grief with Mandy Capehart. You are listening to episode 117, titled In Gentle Earnestness with Christoph Morrow. When we hear stories of childhood abuse and the long-term consequences, it can be hard to know how to respond. And as grievers, we hold great capacity for heavy stories, but without intention, we too easily begin the search for silver linings and the growth before doing the work first and burying ourselves with seed. Christoph Morrow is many things, but most recently, he allowed the work of his own life and grief story to transform into a published work of fiction. While writing an epic fantasy series is not on all of our lists as a healing activity, the act of writing itself and the restructuring of ourselves in the world is necessary for all grievers. So as you listen to this episode, listen to all the details of his life, but listen closer for the resonance of Christoph's heart, as it is an invitation for every one of us to look for the seeds of our own healing. Welcome back to Restorative Grief, everybody. It's Mandy here, and I am bringing a brilliantly complex and beautiful guest today. I'm really excited. Christoph Morrow is an author, and his story is just rich. So I'm excited to see where this goes. Christoph, welcome.
Hello. Oh God. Well, the expectations are very high. So
that's right.
Let's jump. Let's do it.
Well, why don't you get us started? You have, like I said, such a rich story. Tell us what we need to know for today.
I think what's relevant, especially to war against grief. I'll begin there. I grew up in Texas. I'm not wholly compatible with the prevailing views down there for a lot of things. But I love my people for their ability to tell stories. So after growing up in Texas, I joined the military, and I wanted to be a Navy corpsman because I wanted to be a medic for as long as I can remember. I wanted to work in some kind of medicine to help, especially in emergency capacity. And so after that, I discovered without receiving a diagnosis that I had Tourette's. And they didn't know what was happening, but I had something akin to a seizure. But I was conscious for it. So it baffled them. They didn't know what it was. And that's because Tourette's is really a very curious condition. It's a syndrome, which if you don't know, everybody's listening doesn't know. A syndrome is a pattern of behaviors or symptoms that the underlying cause is unknown. And so Tourette's is one of those things that is like a river with eight mouths. You know, like it's pouring inward into like this. And it feeds itself. It feeds one another. So all the different conditions, they exacerbate each other. So I have OCD and ADHD and anxiety, depression. These are the things that I deal with like every single day. Even like chronic suicidal ideation, I combat with that some often. And so a lot of the way I've had to learn to cope, especially on my own, not having parents really to rely on, because I don't have a relationship with mine. They both deal with addiction and violence, whether it be like emotional and verbal, and physical, a lot of physical violence. I don't mean to laugh, but that's just it's a lot. It was an extraordinary amount. So that's, after that, I went to be a journalist, and I won some awards as a photographer and for feature writing, which I, I taught myself to write, so that's and so I had to audition for the job, and then I got and then I stopped writing after I was diagnosed with Tourette's for 5 years, and that was really that really damaged my self-worth, I think. And then when I turned 32, it was less than a month after I turned 32, I received a call from the British Columbian government, who had been on my behalf trying to find me work that I could do reliably. And they couldn't find me anything, and they said, maybe you should write. And so within 10 minutes of that hanging up, I started writing this book. And it's transformed my life completely.
Within 10 minutes of getting off this really devastating, we can't do anything for you phone call, I
No.
started writing this incredible debut novel that went viral and sold thousands of copies with through self-publishing. You say that so casually, yet that's significant.
I really love my work. The part that impresses me most is the amount of hours I put into it. It's regardless of how it, there's something that Rick Wilson said, which he's a funny little news guy. But I appreciate something he said, which was once you like something you've created, it's a success. And I agree with that.
Yeah, that's I think crucial, and especially because we just as people err toward more critical nature, right? We don't necessarily give ourselves space or time to celebrate the things that we do or that we're proud of. We're almost taught not to in a lot of ways. So, especially with a background like yours, where you experience so much trauma at young age and through your entire the entirety of your life, even that ability to celebrate self is a it's a hard-fought characteristic, to say the least.
It's not encouraged, right? Like you said, it's definitely not an encouraged thing. It's like a survival thing. We're trying to find faults, perfecting our defense against something. So every artistic endeavor, if it's somehow a flawed recreation of humanity, we're trying to somehow eliminate that so we can. It's almost out of despair. It's almost like it's very cynical, honestly. It's an understandable cynicism. It comes from grief.
Yeah, 1,000%. And that's something that why I was so excited to speak with you today. Yes, about your work, and I do want to hear about it, but also about how you've catalyzed this experience of loss into this full, rich person you've become. Not because we have to have an experience of grief where it turns into right. We don't want to diminish or minimize our experiences of pain into something without exploring the fullness of what it really looks like for us. But we can intentionally transform and create meaning where it changes something for us. And so for you, obviously, if you took 5 years off of writing after it being something so meaningful, what was it about this? Like, what was actually going on through your mind when you hung up the phone and said, let me start writing this book? Because it had to be more than just someone saying, hey, try writing, right?
It was either write a book or die.
Wow.
I had two choices. That was it. And I was like, there was, because I it was either yeah, because I knew that I was meant to write, because I love it more than anything. And I describe when I say it, I love it more than the sum of my love for all other things. So it's because it is the most pure affection that I can name in my life. Every time I sit down, all we do is dance, right? It's the best part of my day. I think it is a catharsis. And it's like crucial to like my mental health, actually. And I think to like how it was catalyzed, though, is so many things. It's a lifelong obsession, fixation with not seriously, truly, like every single, when I say obsession, I mean literally everything I say, it runs through this filter I'm about to describe. Ever since I was little, I've had I've wanted to be interesting. I wanted to live an interesting life, and I wanted to everything I said to sound as if you could transcribe it into a script, and it would be welcomed like by the quality of my word, you know. So I've every single thing I've ever said, it passes by like that sort of filter. And so I spent basically my entire life trying to inform those ambitions with experience. So what happened partly is that when you want to become a writer, right? I know you know this, you have to learn enough in order to make learned connections that are inspiring to even you. So if you want to write a whole book, that's the way you do it. You have to be able to see all those different things occurring at once and be able to bring them together. Because when that's like your ability to describe reality is so foundational to who we are. So and writing is, I think it's language itself is the only magic we've ever created. And yeah, because it is out of love to understand one another and to be understood.
That strikes a chord with something you said on your viral TikTok that we were chatting about earlier, that writing is a medium where you have to commit yourself to understanding someone. And I, when I
Yeah.
first heard you say that, I thought, okay, stunning. Absolutely. Wow, this is why people don't like to journal and why people don't like to reflect on their own lives, because that means they are committing to understand themselves and specifically their own pain and their own grief story. You were never really given the true option to not address yourself, to not dig in and explore who you are.
Yeah, that's it was really I was it was torture, like it was reminding me every day, like every beating that I got, that there was something wrong with me and that I needed to correct it. And like I'm on the autism spectrum, right? So like my ability to to differentiate between like what they wanted and what I was capable of producing
Yeah.
could never be truly bridged. And so every day was a new iteration of reality for me. It was like, okay, try it this way. Okay, try it this way. Okay, try it this way. Like a freaking robot, just changing very minor things about my personality to like yield the best social result. And what ends up happening is when you're a kid, it's very obvious you're being disingenuous with everyone, or like that you're just that you are, there's no planet of thought, there's no there of personality, that everything else in your life orbits, that everything that you do orbits. There's no identity. I had no identity because my identity was had to be pending, because I couldn't, I mean, the whatever thing I was doing, I got a beating for. So like who I was wasn't right. And so I really studied people obsessively also. And part of it, and that's something else that like psychiatrists and psychologists told me, that you learn to differentiate between the different faces of people if you are abused, because you have to be able to, if especially if they're capricious, and my father definitely was capricious, and so it was impossible to tell unless you learned how to read his face and his expressions, the subtleties, the nuance of their like everything. It was, yeah. And so I learned how to do that at a
Yeah.
young age, way too young.
And I think that what is obviously those things have translated and you've turned them into superpowers, which again, it's not that we want to catalyze what we've experienced and say, okay, here's the purpose for it. But I think often, and that was such a great example of the things that we experience in our trauma and in our grief, how do we create meaning from them? And you didn't take this capricious father who, prone to those mood swings and prone to absolute sudden shifts in behavior, for anyone that doesn't know that word. into just deciding, okay, now I can read the faces of other people. I think that also gives you the ability to recognize, wow, something is shifting in me or in my world as well. What is the impact? What am I going to choose to do with this? And I think that you've described that ability to accept that things are transforming, not just in a robotic way, but in a way that says, but I'm also transforming with this. And when my option feels like death or writing, I am choosing. We know it's not truly quite so black and white, and yet I am holding that space as black and white because it allows me then to choose hope.
Exactly. There's so many things that we do, like little actions that we take that are hints that we have any kind of hope. For example, this is something that I did recently for the first time. I hung a poster on my wall. Now it sounds weird, right? But like having an identity in my own room where I sleep or in my where I live, that's not something that I'm accustomed to. Like having pictures up of myself, or because I always felt so transient. Like I was going to be. Because I moved back and forth between my parents for every year, basically, oh God, for my entire childhood. And so when I did that, that was me sort of, it was a proclamation. I wasn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
So I put the poster on the wall.
I love it. I
It's,
think that's such a simple, like,
yeah.
you reminded me of when I went to college, and that was the first thing I did. I went and specifically purchased posters of things I liked and things I thought would be like, okay, this is more collegey than high school me. And it felt like establishing this new sense of self in the world and grounding to the point you just made and just saying, actually, I agree with who I am, and I'm moving toward myself with more intention every
You
step of
celebrate it. You
the way.
celebrate yourself.
100%.
It's these little acts of faith in yourself, like,
Yes.
and in what you love. Tangible manifestations of like, the self-love, and that's critical. Like, I think about like a lot of people really need a tangible reward in virtually everything I could think of. Like, even therapists. And even you, Mandy, like you do restorative grief coaching, right? So like it's like hard to like exactly determine like how well someone's doing with that stuff. Like ultimately, it's really hard because like you can't there's so there's not really a tangible reward for doing the job. It's more like you are allow you're mending them so they can continue on the hobbling down the road of life, right? That's very, it's got landmines everywhere. And so it's hard.
Yeah, I agree. And you're not wrong with the mending, helping people mend so they can keep moving forward, because that when we are grieving, especially, we suffer secondary losses that we didn't see coming. You know, we have, for to your point, when we are diagnosed with something, we recognize, okay, there are also comorbidities and other things that come along with it that make understanding myself right now just that much more complicated. But there's also then that restructuring self of I like our self identity, restructuring the sense of ourself in the world. And that, what I'm pulling from everything you're saying, is where you have become absolutely a force to be reckoned with, both for yourself, but also for anyone that you are willing to share your story with. Because as a nonfiction book, I'm certain there are pieces of you in that. But as an individual, your story and the way that you have shifted around every roadblock, you know, even if you've had to butt your head up against it multiple times, right?
Oh my God, the wall
Yeah.
of World of Warcraft. Can I just say that? It's the wall of World of Warcraft,
Oh my
which
God.
I still love it, but it's whatever. Go ahead.
It was a good, maybe a coping tool.
I've done something now. Yeah, it was. I've done. Yeah, I lived there when I couldn't live here, right?
Hey, I have been a big fan of daydreaming and visualizing as a coping mechanism for grievers for my entire life. It
Oh,
saved
cool.
you. And so It's funny you say that. Mine was not World of Warcraft because I'm very bad at video games. Mine was going back to the Knights of the Old Republic Star Wars game on the original Xbox because
Wow.
it would pause mid-game. So when, there's action in a video game and you have to hit the buttons in the right order. Wow, I sound so dumb right now, but that's okay. You have to hit the buttons in the right order to get the fight to like punch correctly, or otherwise you just melee fling your character around and then you die. This game, you could pause it. You could say, hey, stop when there's conflict and let me tell you what I want my character to do. And then it would do the move and then it would pause again and say, okay, now what? So I could actually play the game and not just die on the
Yeah.
first level every chance. And Christoph, those are not like, I think the first game is like a 30-hour playtime. The second is 60. I've played them
Yes.
through multiple times. Like,
Ah.
you can see that I am escaping from everything that is painful and terrible in my world when I was going through, like, when I'm like, hey, do we still have those games? I'm like, oh, ooh, okay, hold on a minute.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I
I
think that
love that.
that's for me. And I think that that's the other side for creative people too. And you can tell me how this resonates with you. Being able to get closer to yourself when you're in pain is really, really dangerous work because we're also saying, I'm getting closer to myself. I'm in pain, which means I have capacity to see myself where I'm at and capacity to pull myself forward. And I think that when we don't have the buffer, whether that is a healthy coping mechanism, then we lean toward unhealthy coping mechanisms like drugs and alcohol, like meeting our needs by denying our needs. Like we're not sleeping, so we're just going to stay up and never try to sleep again. Or, I mean, a million different things could fit in there. And I'm thinking about how writing is a manifestation of that creativity that's within us, where the same thing is true in world building video games, right? When we can become immersed in a role playing game or something like that allows us to not be responsible for the creativity, right? We're just partnering with someone else's. I think that also is a way that we extract ourselves from that pain. And so I'm curious how you took all of that and transformed it into your book, like The Second Son, and how, like, what parts of you have shown up in this book? Because it's not like
Oh
Harry Potter retelling. Like, what is it?
oh, it's well, it's like there's hundreds of characters,
Wow.
and they like with dialogue. That's with dialogue. The ones with dialogue. There's more than that, like that don't say anything. If you counted them, I have no idea. But there's it is meant to be like really comprehensive in describing what our struggles are right now. A lot of, especially a lot of the young people like you and I, and like for example, so in the book, there's a literal paradise, and it's meant there's there everyone that lives there when you when you're near death, when you're on the on the eve of death, you bury yourself with a seed of whatever you want to become, and you become that plant or tree or whatever, and like it's just like and you live for thousands of years in that form. And so, like, it's a bunch of retired folks that are become like old people that became trees even after. So, like, they're all old people just living as trees, like all throughout the forest. And they're just like, and the thing is, there's a number of qualities to like the to that that are quite cute. Like when if you're a fruit making tree, you can hear the person singing songs that they put into the fruit. Like, so they can put like stories and things. So when you eat it, you hear their stories. And it's really and so I have stuff that's really cute, like a little poem, and it's meant to be, but it's meant to be an allegory for boomers living in paradise, sort of right now, financial paradise with the chosen few, and then everyone else in the rest of the world is living a sort of Game of Thrones type life. But if in terms of like violence and content and that sort of thing, I would split the difference between Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones in terms of that. So like, there's not, and you know what I mean? So it's not, I'm not really into violence like that. Like for the sake of demonstrating cruelty to an extreme that's like, that is unnecessary. Yeah. So like, I, you know, it can be done with less viciousness, right? And so yeah, anyway, so it's about and excuse me, I was going to say, I also Game of Thrones reference the notion that if you've read the Game of Thrones, the way that the book is structured, the first chapter is about one part of the world with different characters. The second chapter is a different part of the world with different characters, and third, same thing. And then these characters like and stories converge in subtle ways and in actual tangible ways. That's the way I structured my book, is the exact same way. So there's like it's a whole thing, and it's meant it's every part of me. Every person is a fractured is a shard of my personality, and it's a sort of confession, truly, in a lot of ways, about what I love and who I love, but in other ways, it's like what I fear in other characters. Like characters have qualities that I'm afraid of ever letting consume me and become me. You know, there's so many things.
When you first described your book as having hundreds of characters, that's where my mind went. It was like, oh, like Game of Thrones, because I did read all of those books and they were 1,000% escapist for me because I was in a job that was very mundane and detailed and I couldn't handle it. And so my brain being overworked would go and then overwork trying to remember all of the storylines and the connections. But it was rich and brilliant. And I often wondered as it was being written how much of this world building and these individuals were reflective, not of people that they knew, because no one can contain that many people externally, but how much of this is a reflection of the internal world of the author?
Oh, it's also, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention, it's also about climate change. I was going to say it's comprehensive in that there's climate change, civil war, kind of slavery. There's gay love. I actually have like gay love in there. There's non-binary people. There's people with all kinds of disabilities. There's no racism or sexism, though. I just didn't want that. I wanted women and people that present as women to like be able to read this and like not really have the baggage of like, oh, you think you're strong this time, you think you're a strong lady, you're gonna go out to war with us, you think you're gonna be able to defend the kingdom. I just can't stand it. I get really annoyed by that. So because it's not really relevant, if you can, anyway. So it's I wanted to really get away from that. So there's none of that in there. It's meant to be an adventure for everyone, regardless of like anything about you.
That's actually stunning that you wanted it to be so invitational. You almost idealized your world because, and I'm listening and I'm trying not to go into like, oh, as a, mental health professional, what's the story behind that? But mostly because I can see the compassion and the generosity it must have cost you to create a world like that because of your experiences, because of the reality of what you've experienced, the reality you are offering to other people is completely different, but gentle, it sounds.
Yeah, that's actually it is like I wrote it actually originally to be a sort of children's book. I actually consider it a children's book, and I know that sounds insane because of the way there's like some passages that are like, we contend justice is among our senses, but its chance conception in nature exposes our conceit when we sunder our marriage to reason for the profits of incurious vengeance. You know, like that's the sentence of my book, and that's like. But it truly is like if it's I know that children, like when they're exposed to words, like more and more words, the better their vocabulary is going to be. And my there's a lot of sentences in here that are structured in a very complex way, I think. I tried to anyway. And that's to encourage that growth, because being like for me, it It's meant to really truly inspire people, like kids, like because there are like there's actual kids in the book, like they're featured all throughout the book. It's really quite cute. So most of the time. but there is death, and there is like it's really, really sad. And there's like, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And there's 1,000 short stories and vignettes and poems and songs, and everyone when you encounter in the book, they feel human. Every single person that I discuss in the book, regardless of who they are and their convictions, like even politically, I still describe them in terms of like their humanity, to sustain that, because I think that if we refuse the humanity of people that are vile, truly vile, then we don't defend ourselves against the accusation that would be true later on, also, when we say we're not like them, because they're them, that we're us, that we've always been us, we're not like them, and that so not accepting that also is rather dangerous precedent. Anyway.
We've been talking a lot about kind of in my restorative grief world lately about abusive family members and abusive traumatic situations, both as children but as adults as well. And what you just said really landed in a lot of ways in kind of not the conclusion, but in a clean summary of what we've come to recognize, just that. We cannot steal the humanity of someone else in order to reduce them down to our villain and to make them easier to hate, easier to compartmentalize so that we can find what we think is healing. That we have to allow the fullness of their humanity, the both and of my experience. They are both traumatic and abusive and human and part of my story, in order to genuinely recognize where healing exists in that situation for us. And I have my own story of unhealthy, unsafe experiences growing up. And it's my own reckoning right now, realizing, wow, by the time this airs, it will be, I think, 9 months ago, something very awful happened. And I felt a way about it that I didn't think I would feel. And to this day, I'm still like, why in the world was that my response? And I'm being shady right now about what I say because I haven't done the work myself for it yet, right? I'm still trying to exist within both ends. And I think that the way that you're articulating your story and sharing your experience of everything you've gone through and so much that you haven't even mentioned that I know you carry is incredibly gentle and very, very generous toward your life experience.
I honestly, there's a number of things that I anticipated for myself that were born of ego. But when I tell people that I have, you've seen The Office, I'm sure, right?
Oh, of course.
So I had an Andy Bernard upbringing. So when I tell people I have an Andy Bernard upbringing, they totally understand. It's so great. So I
Yeah.
say the reason why I'm like this is because I had an Andy Bernard upbringing. And I also, but before, my example was to say that I only let my ego get this big because I needed to climb out of a well. And it's true. I was alone in myself, in my praise, right? And so that was an important part of like sustaining
Well, and
growth.
I would even say too, I don't perceive excessive ego driving the way you talk about yourself and your work. I perceive gentleness and tenderness toward yourself. And so I was actually going to ask, what was it? How do you continue to demonstrate tenderness and gentleness toward yourself? Because it doesn't read as ego.
Because I consider my work more important than me. It sounds weird, but it's like it's it sounds like counter like the thing is that true like the reason why I say that is like for example, I've been around for this whole time, and it wasn't I nobody cared. But then I wrote a book, and then now they do, and I realize it's because of the book, and it's because the book, the reason why it matters more to me than even myself is because it still is me. It's just me distilled into everything that I love and hope to ever be, and all the things that I don't, and all the things that I don't know. I just my book is dedicated to all who love in gentle earnest. And it's really hard because I wanted to in the future, I wanted people to be able to look at my internet, like TikTok and all the different social medias, and because I'm quite like frank about my life in many ways on there. And so, and that's partly because I want people, if they want to be artists in the future, like to be able to have the, because I've already done it, you know, like I've already like revealed that, like what it looks like, the turmoil. Because they talk about Van Gogh, like they say that he's the tortured artist, and he did his, you know, he was tortured, and that's what made his art great. But like he did his best work when he was actually in recovery, and he was like being medicated and all that stuff. So that's the way that I feel about it too. I wanted that to dispel that notion that it's all about suffering and torment, infernal, that inferno within. It's not about that. It is about it's truly about coming through that storm, like with something like underneath your shirt, and you're just like trying to get that wisdom to the end to impart, like, because it's all you care about is making a difference. Like, I wanted to live a life of consequence. And now I've had people write me to say that my favorite two compliments reviews have been one that was that I used to not like reading, but I read your book, and I was never really good at it. But I read your book, and now I really like to read, and I read all the time now. And that's the best. That's best. And then the other favorite was someone said that even if I did nothing for the rest of my life, I made my time on Earth worth it. Those are my two favorites. Oop, oop.
I think that that's I first of all, congratulations on those beautiful, honest offerings, because yes, as an author, my God, the words that your people hand back to you when they quote yourself, I'm sure that's happened as well. When you get quoted your own work back to you, and you can see how it impacted someone else. And sometimes someone will do that to me, and I'll be like, wait, I wrote those words? Are you sure? I mean, I know I didn't steal any of it, so I guess you're right. Those are my words, but damn, I didn't even fully understand the weight of what I was writing or saying at the time, I think.
No.
And that is a testament to that person that you've become, that has identified the values of what matters to you and really found the way forward for you to internalize those values and push them back out to other people in a way that does create purpose and meaning and connection. And I love you, what you said about your book dedication. It is dedicated to people who are loving in gentle earnest. That is such a simple and sincere legacy.
Yeah, that's everything I do in life is for those people. Because it's like life is like really hard and stuff, and the ones that I try to make it better, I'm not always successful at that. Like, you know, I'm like I try it takes a lot of effort because I have Tourette's and a number of other conditions. Like my brain doesn't regulate emotion very well. And so I'm flawed, and so I really have to contend with that basically every day, and try to mediate this, like, you know, monster of a symptom, which makes me often sometimes incompatible with society, you know, Shakespeare.
Yeah, and
So
I think the beauty of who you have become, and
Shakespeare.
Christoph, you are absolutely a gem of a human. So hear me when I say this. I'm not just like, oh yeah, you're a great guest. Good job. Wrote a book. Way to go. The sincerity you present with far outweighs any of the negative social impact. That's not even how I want to say it, but like the way that you show up in connection with others, and we having just met, your honesty and your integrity are so evident that anything else just adds to the richness of who you are. And so I love your story, and I'm sure you fought to say the same and often won't say the same thing about what you've experienced. But I think the way that you have, again, brought it all into this place where you can say, okay, I accept where I'm at. I accept what I've gone through. And not only that, I'm going to recognize, wow, there are other people who need to hear that there is space for them to, yes, daydream and idealize what the world could be for them, to feel safe in the pocket of a book, even if it just lasts as long as 500 pages, that they can then bring themselves to this position of like reflection and imagination for their own world and what's possible.
There's so many, and there's so much great art out there too that I was a it was a an excellent font, indispensable font of just spirit of discovery and and courage to actually impart, to write that down and to describe, because there's just a lot of the time I'm actually going to be discussing someone's true circumstances, and people have written me that have disabilities. They're like, you wrote this in the book, and this happens to me all the time. And I was like, I know, because I looked into this. I've read about the nuance of people that suffer, that have deaf, people with deafness and that sort of thing, and other conditions, and it's a critical part, I think.
Well, it's compassion. It's the manifestation of all the self-compassion you've learned to internalize, and being able to go there for yourself is crucial before we can go there for others. And I think that that is what makes you and probably your work stand out so differently, is that oftentimes we'll have people who want to write and they'll do research, and that's fine. But if they haven't gone inward toward themselves first, then the outward expression of that is going to feel forced isn't the right word. It's going to feel structured in a way that feels very, that can be like insincere or ineffective long term.
It's incomplete. It'll be incomplete for sure, because it doesn't, it's a facade, right? It looks like a it, it's it looks like it's a window, but it's a window. It's a window that's been painted onto the wall, And so, you're not really seeing into the heart of that person. And that could be that. Yeah, that's probably the most frustrating thing, I think, a lot of people, with a lot of just media these days, suffers that sin of insincerity. And that it's trying to market. In fact, I actually had someone, a publisher, was talking to me about my book, and they were like, I wrote a kid's book also called Liam Earns a Friend. And it's about a little boy that finds a dinosaur egg, amongst a bunch of others that had definitely been lost to the weather, the cold weather. The mother find he the baby a baby dinosaur is born from this egg, and when the mother finds out that one of her babies survived, she takes the baby back, and she's like, I can't, I need to take care of this baby, because this is my baby, it's the only one that made it. And so the boy, in order to be able to play with the dinosaur and be their friend and be his friend or their friend, he made them gifts, he knitted them sweaters, and brought them food and stuff, and to prove to the mother also that his love and it was sincere. And they told me, they were wanted to do different artwork that was more consistent with what you see in children's books. And the art that my ex and I put into the book is was like we she and I went through 500 different images, sort of trying to figure out which ones we were going to use. And they she And the publisher, I told him no, because this is meant to inspire. This is meant to, it's not meant to be the same as everything else.
It needs to be different because it's a different expression from a different person. And
Yeah.
I love that. I think you're, I mean, I can get where publishers are coming from, right? But they're not always correct.
That's
Yeah.
boring.
They're kind of boring sometimes, let's
That's
be honest.
boring. Yeah, like when Dickens was rejected like 63 times during his career, one of the
Gosh.
greatest writers in English ever. Like, just so you everybody knows, like the greatest, one of the greatest writers of all time. Yeah, he had haters.
Isn't it funny how we think everybody's going to like my work? No, they very much are not going to all like your work. Most of them will hate it. And that's okay. That doesn't mean you're necessarily being a total horrible person. So maybe check yourself just in case. However, yeah. Oh my gosh. Christoph, what is, if you could like leave us on one little note here, because you've shared so much beauty and said so many incredible things and you've opened a lot of pathways into creativity and self-compassion for people who are listening. What is, how do you want to sum this up?
Well, before we go on the thing, I said that justice and redemption are folly, but to seek them is not. And the redemption part is the most important part of that, because neither justice will never be achieved in this life. There's the crimes. There's never going to be a true accounting of the crimes that we've all committed against one another ever, and so there will never be justice. And we should just concede that. It's more about seeking redemption. How do you find that? And you will never ever truly gain that either. There will be people who will not restrain themselves from holding whatever against you. But that doesn't mean you get to quit. You have to seek that redemption anyway. And that's because it's the youth yet tested and the old yet redeemed, right?
What it reveals within us, I think, is just as ultimately more important, in fact, than what it reveals outside of us. What it results is internal growth and integration. Yeah, I agree. Christoph, you're a gem. Thank you so much for making space and sharing your story and your work with us. And I'm just so grateful that we got to connect. Thank you.
Me too. It was really fun. Thanks, Mandy.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to episode 117 of Restorative Grief. I felt such a sense of compassion and kindness just rolling off this interview. And even now, as I'm reflecting back on the conversation, I'm thinking of every one of you listening and how you might be interpreting Christoph's story. So I want to invite you to soften, to become a bit gentler and more earnest toward yourself right now. It would be easy to compare your experiences with the depth and complexity of his own and wonder or should yourself into something you believe you might need. As you do your own grief work and reflect on what you've carried, consider what you might hold as dearly as Christoph holds writing. Becoming an author seems like it was always on his radar, as he said. Our own right pathway forward is often more carved than we suspect, but the shadows we see along the way can be intimidating and keep us from pursuing the thing that we need the most to heal. If this is your first time listening to the show, thank you for making this a part of the beginning of your new year. Grief work is a beautiful way to offer yourself the much needed compassion and kindness that allows us to heal. And you gotta start with yourself. Okay, find and plant your own seeds of healing before you try to create growth for someone else. Please consider subscribing to the show, leaving a review, and if you want more content, you can join the Restorative Grief Patreon or free coaching group online. The links are available in the show notes for both of those, as are the links to find Christoph on TikTok and his book. I hope you'll support his work as well as mine as you move forward toward yourself with a little more intentionality and kindness this year. And before we go, as always, one last thing. Please remember, the only solution for grief is to do the work of grieving. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.